coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Summer is often a downtime for Delaware politics, but not this summer, which this week saw a special legislative session to address issues stemming from Delaware's first property reassessment in decades.
I think that the special session is a step forward. I'm not sure it solves everything. There's still, based on the little I've seen, the little data I've seen, there's some discrepancies in assessments. It's got to be fair. It's got to be accurate.
We have Governor Matt Myers take on this week's special session. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our conversation with Governor Meyer also covers the proposed data center in Newcastle County, Port of Wilmington expansion, and more. Plus, Arts Playlist highlights a Middletown artist showing at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery this month. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you an in-depth sit-down with Governor Matt Myer. Myer joined me and DPM's state politics reporter, Sarah Petrowich, earlier this week for a discussion of topics ranging from this week's General Assembly special session on property reassessment to the massive proposed data center near Delaware City, the rollout of recreational use marijuana sales, and more. Our conversation started with this week's legislative special session and what it delivered. Are you writ large, please, satisfied with the short-term solutions that were delivered to provide residents some relief for the substantial tax increases that some of them are seeing on their bills after reassessment?
My family came to Delaware when I was a baby, and my parents chose to come here because it was an affordable place to live, high-quality community, great schools. I ran because I think that we need to maintain that characteristic of Delaware, of being an affordable place to live, having really high-quality communities and high-quality schools. I think there's a sense across our state, Newcastle County certainly, in recent weeks with the property tax bill that we're losing that. And so anything that takes a step forward to say we're maintaining our low property tax state, you know, designation is really important to me. I think that the special session is a step forward. I'm not sure it solves everything. There's still, based on the little I've seen, the little data I've seen, there's some discrepancies in assessments. It's got to be fair. It's got to be accurate. And we also have to make sure we're investing money to improve our schools. So I think there are some things that were done that were really good. I signed all the bills already, you know, immediately after they were passed by the House and the Senate, or the Senate and the House. But I think it's really important that we keep our eye on the ball. We don't just say, woohoo, we're done, pat ourselves on the back. There are people still hurting. There are people looking at their property tax bills even today. Even once adjustments are made, I think they're talking about some districts potentially making some changes and resending bills. I imagine there's still going to be people out there that are hurting, and we're going to keep looking and seeing what we can do.
But this was clearly a Band-Aid solution for now. And you look at it that way. Is that fair?
Well, I think it was a step forward. You got to understand that for over four decades, they didn't reassess in Newcastle County. In Kent County, it was 3.5 decades. In Sussex County, it's over 5 decades. This is not a problem that's going to be fixed overnight. It's not a problem that's going to be fixed by one person, right? Or even one government. It's county government, school district, state government, all saying, okay, how do we get this system right that has been wrong for a long time? And so I wouldn't say that this special session was a Band-Aid. I think it was a step to address, you know, an attempt to address decades of inaccuracies in tax bills that Delawareans are receiving. The county government under my leadership and now under Marcus Henry's leadership up in Newcastle County took some steps forward. The school districts have taken some step forward, maybe a few missteps along the way. They're course correcting. And I think in the end, we're going to be all right. There's still a lot more work to do.
At one point during the special session, you were personally called to the floor to testify on how Newcastle County carried out its reassessment process in your capacity as the former county executive. That call was from Republican Representative Mike Smith, who then took to Facebook to criticize your lack of involvement in the bills. House Speaker Melissa Minor Brown also told members of the press there seems to be a lot of, quote, unanswered questions around Newcastle County's reassessment process under your tenure, and said she'd also be happy to hear from you. Do you have a response to what these legislators
said? There's a lot of politics. I mean, Speaker Minor Brown and I have had numerous conversations in recent days about reassessment, and I'm happy to answer any questions or you have about reassessment. So I don't know what kind of politics people – anytime there's a there's a crisis like this, anytime there's unfairness, there are people who jump in and try to take advantage of it. Since day one, since we were sued back when I was county executive, I said, how do we put our head down and how do we solve this for the good of everyone in the state? This is something that's been an issue long before I first ran for office as a sixth and seventh grade math teacher 8 years ago. This is something that the lack of a reassessment has done active harm to our children. This is something that we need elected officials to stand up with courage and say, we're going to fix this. It's hard. And we're going to fix it in a way that's fair to everyone. Clearly, tax bills came out the last few months in New Castle County and people looked and said, this isn't really fair. So we got to put our pencils back on the drawing board and see what we can come up with.
Having said that, do you have any second thoughts on the process and how it was handled in New Castle County? Or would you go back and change anything? Or at this point say, like, hey, looking forward, we need to do this, the county needs to do this, somebody needs to do X, Y, or Z?
I think that someone should take a look at the reassessments that Tyler Technology did. There seemed to be some clear errors. One of the errors, I believe, is a family home, my parents' house, that is $300,000 is assessed $300,000 higher than an appraisal we got a couple weeks ago. $5,000 increase in my parents' school taxes. School tax, my parents are my dad's in his 90s. These are school taxes I'm ultimately going to be responsible for. You're talking about more than doubling of school taxes. I'm just sharing that. I know many Delawareans and many New Castle County residents are facing the same. So I think there are a number of issues into that, those dramatic spikes. I think one of the issues is we got to make sure that the assessed values are actually accurate.
Because a lot of people have talked about Tyler Technologies did the reassessments in all three counties.
Right. There were actually – I tried as county executive to get all three counties to bid it together because I thought we'd get a better deal. Before that even, to be honest, I didn't want to use Tyler Technologies. I thought that we could – listen, you want to know your home value? Have you been on Zillow? Like, why are we spending $10 million, $15 million to pay a contractor to go around?
I would assume it's because that's what the court would expect
correct.
You to do. Like, the court's not going to accept Zillow estimates.
It became very clear that we couldn't use the latest technology to do it. We'd have to send people door to door. I personally, and I expressed it fairly freely, did not think that made the most sense. There's something called the IAAO, International Association of Assessment Officers. They have standards. Their standard is that after 7 or 10 years, you have to send people door to door. We sent people door to door. When I look at the results as a Delawarean, just looking at some samples, some of it seems to be accurate. A lot of it seems not to be accurate.
And I guess there's also the issue of commercial versus residential, right? And that's where, you know, perhaps like you need something different. And maybe Tyler Technology just didn't do right by New Castle County as opposed to Sussex and Kent.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that in particular. But it's certainly true that there has been a movement towards, you know, where residential values are increasing at a higher rate than commercial values in New Castle County, and that's an issue.
You mentioned school taxes. Additional questions and concerns have been raised over school districts' ability to raise revenues by up to 10% following a reassessment. School boards across the state utilized this measure for the first time in decades, as you mentioned, due to lack of prior reassessments, which ultimately resulted in higher tax bills for a lot of residents, particularly in New Castle County, as we've been discussing. While it didn't pass during special session, there is legislation on the table that would require schools to prove an actual deficit if they wanted to increase revenues following a reassessment. Do you support implementing some variation of a burden of proof requirement for school districts?
We need to take a comprehensive look at how our schools are funded, making sure it's sustainable for the long term. It's no longer acceptable in 2025 that districts in wealthier areas are able to get referendums passed and districts in less wealthy areas are having more difficulty passing referenda because, of course, the consequence of that is greater levels of inequality. We're going to look hard at all that stuff and hopefully by January come forward with something not just to address tax rates and how people are taxed to pay for their schools, but also making sure that every dollar of educational expenditure is efficient. I think there's a problem. Let's just say it. General Benson, the adjutant general of our National Guard, let's say, let me give it to you sugar free. Let's be honest here in our small group. I don't know if anyone's listening, but let's be honest, there are a lot of Delawareans who the biggest problem they have with paying their school taxes is they don't feel like they're getting a return. My experience, when I was in seventh grade for my dad's birthday, I spent months on a paper route saving up money for like a $70 baseball glove. When I went to buy it, they gave me a little discount. And so I got a little cheaper. That felt good because I worked hard and I earned something that was really a quality glove. Maybe 70 bucks doesn't get you much of a baseball glove now. But back then, that was a lot of money for a baseball glove. My experience, and it's true in Delaware, and I think it's true in many places in the country, people are willing to pay for something that's high quality. I think there's a sense and a frustration. Wait a second, we're paying all this money for schools that, you know, 10, 12, 14 of which are scoring in the single digits in proficiency. That's not acceptable. So we have to make sure not just we're taxing people the right amount, a fair amount, based on assessment that's fair, but we have to make sure we're following the dollars and they're being expended efficiently.
I want to talk a little bit about that some more. But first, I do want to just go back to something you said about referendum and referendum reform. Do you have an idea in your mind of what referendum reform should look like, what should be done in terms of making sure, as you mentioned, that this issue of like certain districts can get referendums passed and other ones can't, or they can only get it passed if they do a second version where they tell their people they're going to cut everything. Do you have a sense of what you would propose to make that system work better?
Yes.
What is it?
You'll hear more, Tom.
No hints.
I don't think for anyone trying to run an organization, imagine if every 40 years, every 40 years, or every 5 years, or at some, you know, occurrence of a court issuing an order or a county making a decision, you suddenly could increase all your revenues 10%. And outside of that, it was really, really hard. That's not a sensible way to run any organization. So we're going to take a step back and look at how do we run these organizations in a way where getting revenue makes sense. Because this is not just any organization. It's just about the most important organizations in our community and in our society, and that's our schools and our kids.
Of all this, referendum reform, property reassessment, all inherently, as you've made clear, tied to the whole issue of education funding in the state. And that is largely right now in the hands of the Public Education Funding Commission, which did offer five recommendations earlier this year to move forward, including a hybrid funding framework that blends elements of the current unit count system and a weighted block grant approach. From your perspective, ultimately, is the path forward focusing on the commission's work and moving it along as quickly as possible, using what your education secretary, Cindy Martin, has called a holistic approach, rather than piecemeal legislation trying to, because a lot of people have said that kind of like the piecemeal fixing of the unit count is how we kind of got in this situation. I mean,
right.
Is it better to take that holistic approach and let the commission do its work before a lot of different legislation starts coming up?
Understand at the outset what I'm trying to do, like at a high level. Mm-hmm. We have a funding formula. The way our schools is funded is based on a formula that was written in the 1940s. It's the oldest formula in the country. When I say that, I am not the first Delawarean to say that. I'm not the first elected official to say that. There probably have been people sitting in this seat on the show who've been saying this. I don't know how old the green is, but probably decades ago, you would have had people on the radio saying, we need to change the funding form. My guess is, you know, when I was in school 30, 40 years ago, people were probably saying, hey, we need to change the funding form. It has not changed in any substance, a little bit on the edges, but this formula needs to be changed. That's why when I came into office, I said, I'll give you 6 months. They came up with a framework. I think it needs to be wholesale, holistic changes. There are dramatic steps forward that I think we're going to see by the end of the year because of some of the dynamics of reassessment. I was convinced, okay, we can wait one more year just to get it right, because it's very hard to set a formula and then there's reassessment that changes all the variables. So we're looking at by fall of 2026, but within a year, having a formula that serves Delawareans.
And I know your education secretary has said, like, all this stuff is part of it. You know, the referendum reform,
yeah.
And it will probably take some time, maybe, you know, I think when I talked to her last, it was like a 5-6 year, like, rollout of the whole thing. I mean,
yeah.
And is that how you view it? There's going to be decisions made and then there's going to be implementation.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Okay.
So, I mean, to Delawareans, I just want to assure Delawareans that I grew up in Delaware. this is a low property tax jurisdiction state. When I look at the numbers, I look at the needs of our schools, I fundamentally believe we can still continue to be a low property tax jurisdiction state. We can still continue to have regular reassessments that value your property accurately, and we can make appropriate investments in our school to have one of the best school systems in the country.
You're listening to our interview with Governor Matt Meyer on this week's edition of The Green. Our conversation continues in a moment with Governor Meyer's thoughts on the status of the Port of Wilmington expansion project and the proposed data center project near Delaware City. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. After covering this week's legislative special session on property reassessment and state education funding in our previous segment, we continue our interview with Governor Matt Meyer, delving into several other issues, including Port of Wilmington expansion, the proposed data center project near Delaware City, and the start of legal marijuana sales in the first state.
I want to move on to something else. Port of Wilmington. What can you tell us about where things stand with the Edgemoor expansion project? And I guess more specifically from you, does your vision differ from what's largely been discussed about this idea since it was first broached in 2018?
Well, I mean, one of the initial proponents, I think the guy that might have even created the idea of the port expansion back when they were talking about doing it right by the Delaware Memorial Bridge, the River's Edge Project, Kamoko Harris is my appointee on the port board. So I'm a strong believer in port expansion. The number of working class jobs it creates would be wonderful for the city of Wilmington, wonderful for Newcastle County, wonderful for our whole state. I've been by the port several times. I've spoken to foreign governments about expanding opportunities to both import into the port and export out of the port. The port project itself remains held up. The port project is moving forward in a number of ways. Mm-hmm. The port project is not able to move forward in every way until a permit is issued from the Army Corps of Engineers. There was a court case about it. We're working on it. We're working with the Army Corps of Engineers, and we hope by the end of the year that situation will be resolved.
Do you feel like – maybe it's not shovel-ready, but once that litigation is handled, do you feel like there's actionable – things to do to get that project started?
I think, well, it's already happening, Tom. It's not like it's already moving forward. It's a very complex project. There are a lot of moving parts. Are there going to be other hiccups? Almost certainly, yes. There will be. We're talking about at least a $500, $600 million project, probably more expensive than that. Just the financing of it is complex. The construction aspects of it are complex, and obviously a number of the legal aspects are complex as well. But my administration is fully committed to seeing this through and seeing it through for the good of Delawareans and the people of Northern Delaware.
There was some public controversy between you and legislative leadership over the makeup of the Port Board, and lawmakers have reconstituted the Port of Wilmington Expansion Task Force. So you've got these two separate bodies working. Is there a need to get everyone on the same page to help move this project forward?
I think we're on the same page as far as moving the port forward. I think there's a lot of politics behind the background that has a lot to do with the election last year. I don't pay much attention to it. My job is to deliver for Delawareans, especially in this day and age when there's I think working people are being crushed. I think working people are being crushed by a president who has deceived them and lied to them, quite frankly, and that's President Trump. I think working people and potentially ports are being crushed by tariffs, by a national tax that just sort of came out of nowhere and is totally inappropriate. It's hard to find an economist who says this is a good idea. There's no space for us to have, you know, little disagreements about election last year. Let's move forward. Let's build this port and let's serve Delaware.
On the topic of economic development, there's a significant amount of pushback on a massive proposed data center project near Delaware City, specifically over some of the electrical grid possible concerns, water use, other environmental factors. Where do you stand on this?
We have a massive energy shortage in our country and the region, and PJM, right, the exchange that Delaware and a number of states are on. Delaware imports way too much electricity. We need to produce electricity, and having a large data center come here and just draw electricity off the grid is just a non-starter for me. I will do everything I can to make sure something like that doesn't happen. Data centers, in most cases, don't create that many permanent jobs. Often they'll mean a lot in terms of construction jobs, which are important, but the construction jobs after it's built largely go away. This data center project proposed in Delaware City, from what I've read about it and what I understand, is a large multi-phase project that I think will take, you know, 6, 7, 10 years to build out, which is real jobs and real opportunity. We don't want to, you know, in a changing economy, moving towards an AI economy, we don't want to lose out. We don't want to be left behind in some backwater economy. So we're looking at what we can do to make sure we can do projects, whether it's data centers or other things, with the energy capabilities so that when a project comes in to create jobs, to help advance Delaware and advance Delaware's economy, we're not spiking everyone's power bill, because that we're just not going to do. There's energy capacity available, but also making sure it's sustainable. A lot of the cooling of these data centers is really bad for the environment,
use, yeah.
The water use. But there are some new technologies out there that we believe are more sustainable. And so not just with data centers, but with anything. We're going to look at it. How does Delaware benefit? And with at least some of these initial data center proposals that I've seen, it's hard for me to see how Delaware benefits.
Is there any concern? It looks like the first phase of this has already kind of been filed and in process. Do you see any possibility of doing anything to stop that first phase, or is it a situation where that horse may already be out of the barn and just look at the second phase?
I don't have all the details on it. It sounds like with respect to local government and local land use, it is a by right project, I think. I know the county government is working hard to see what the law is around it. We, too, are looking to make sure that it doesn't have a disproportionate impact, a bad impact on spiking. Energy prices are already way too high. People's Delmarva prices just in the past 6 months since I've been in office have been ridiculous. Mine, in my house, you're talking about, I'm used to $70, $80, $100 bills. They're $300, $350. I'm fortunate in a place where I can, it's no fun, but I can handle that. And I understand a lot of Delaware families is something they can't handle. So we're looking out for people. We're going to do everything we can to stop that from happening.
Is there also kind of concurrent that work needed to be done on the inherent electric grid problems you're talking about in terms of not importing as much, whether it be wind or other opportunities for the state to increase its portfolio?
Yeah, stay tuned. I signed a bill to move the offshore wind project forward, which is not directly a Delaware project, but it's basically adds to the energy grid in a substantive way, in an important way. I've already cut a ribbon on one of the largest solar projects in Delaware history in Kent County. And there's some other stuff coming.
Yeah, switching gears. Adult use recreational marijuana sales started this month. The state reported $94,000 in revenue in the first 3 days. How do you feel about the progression of the rollout, especially under new marijuana commissioner Josh Sanderlin?
Look, Commissioner Sanderlin is fine. We're very lucky. He's not someone from Delaware. He's one of the leading thinkers on this issue. And he looks at it from a business and community aspect, whereas traditionally Delaware's looked at it as a public safety issue. But what are we doing with marijuana? Number one, we got to make sure communities are sustainable and they're safe and they're protected. I think there's a lot of concern in communities. I have small children. Like, what are we doing? Do we want this thing all around our kids? Do we want to go? I don't know how many of you have been to New York or San Francisco lately, but you go outside and there's that stench. That's not Delaware. And we're doing everything to make sure that we continue to retain the same communities we have. We also have a historic obligation. Marijuana and marijuana enforcement in this state has not been equitable. There are people in our communities today, almost all black and brown people, who've been imprisoned for years and years for using and selling marijuana, where people of different colors of skin have not had that same experience. We need to make sure we use whatever revenue we have to address that historic wrong going forward. And also, I mean, as a number of legislators remind me, there is a revenue opportunity there for the state. But for me, it's clearly third. We're continuing to watch and monitor to make sure communities are being protected as this, you know, economic opportunity grows, and make sure people are safe.
And there is still an important piece of the puzzle here, which is Senate Bill 75 that would address zoning issues that have limited where cannabis facilities can be located in counties. Will you sign Senate Bill 75?
Stay tuned. You'll hear soon. We will be taking action very shortly. I've made it very clear, listen, I have local government background. I don't think it's appropriate that when state government likes local government regulation, they say, yeah, we support it. And when they don't like local government regulation, they overrule it. At the same time, it's important for communities that this moves forward.
Is letting it go into effect without your signature on the table?
It's always on the table.
Can I ask one question about the thing you just brought up?
It's your show, Tom. You can ask whatever you want.
Local versus state control. Because it seems to be coming up in a lot of different areas here.
Of course, yeah.
Is that something—
Not the first time.
No, I know. But I'm wondering, does it seem like it is— we're seeing a little bit more of that butting up against each other in this state? Then maybe we haven't. I mean, it has been an issue before. I'm not denying that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, but it does seem like recently it's been a little bit more testy.
I will say this: as someone, and now I'm spending a lot more time with other governors from other states around the country, often larger state governors. Mm. That is interesting in Delaware because we're a small state. I think state representatives and state senators, in particular, and governors, are much more involved in sort of the local pothole type issues. That Governor Newsom. And even Governor Stein in North Carolina, or Governor Shapiro in Pennsylvania, Governor Moore, they don't get involved at the level we often get involved. So I was talking to Governor Polis of Colorado about marijuana regulation just the other day, and he's just like, just let the counties do what they like. He has too many counties to know. I was asking, what's the regulation of counties? He's like, I have no idea. He's like, some do it, some don't. I don't really know.
Yeah, he's
know.
Not going to run into the problem, though, where like if there's enough zoning laws, like there's like literally no place to put the facilities. Right?
Yeah, that's
probably
right.
Not a problem for him.
That's right. That's probably, yeah, Colorado's much larger. I think it's a 3-mile limitation from school. So we're working directly with Sussex County. We're going to see what we can do.
Continuing with political controversy. There's been continued drama over the legislatively created Diamond State Hospital Cost Review Board, which is politically appointed, and they will review hospital budgets to make sure their spending is in line with the state's healthcare spending benchmark. There was extensive controversy over the creation of the board while the bill was making its way through the General Assembly, and it is currently facing legal challenges from ChristianaCare. There is a lot of nuance here, but when all is said and done, the goal of this board is to curb rising healthcare costs in Delaware. You have made it clear that affordable healthcare is very important to you. So with all of the turmoil surrounding this board, do you think it's more trouble than it's worth?
Do I think the board is more trouble than it's worth? I think we got to do everything we can in our power to make sure there's affordable healthcare for Delawareans. There are a number of ways to do it. One is a hospital review board. There are other things I talked about a lot in the campaign, like competition. We basically have three to four monopoly hospital systems in our state: ChristianaCare in Newcastle County, Bay Health in Kent County, BB in Eastern Sussex, and Tidal Health in Western Sussex. You know, monopoly services for anyone doesn't bode well. If I'm the only person selling milk in the town, I can charge any price I want and I can give you any quality you want. And I think we're seeing some of that. So we're doing everything we can to address that situation. I think the review board is potentially one tool in the toolbox. As you know, it's under litigation. I can just about feel my phone blowing up saying, don't say this, don't say that. But I think it's important that we move forward with it as a tool in the toolbox to hold the hospitals accountable.
So it's important that you say for it to move forward, although it obviously wasn't done under your administration. So I'm just curious, is it a priority for you, or are there other avenues?
Our priority is doing anything we can to bring down healthcare costs. It's also important to note that not only was I not in office when House Bill 350 was introduced, passed, and signed into law, it was first consummated and most of the members were appointed, but also the landscape is changing pretty rapidly. We have estimates of up to 70,000 Delawareans, about 7% of Delawareans, that due to loss of Affordable Care Act subsidies and changes to Medicaid have no health insurance. Keep in mind, when you say have no health insurance, that actually doesn't mean they don't go to the doctor. It just means the state doesn't pay for them going to the doctor anymore. They're still going to go, and hospitals are going to be left hung out to dry. There are estimates across the country that thousands of hospitals may go out of business because this bill, the big bill that President Trump signed a few weeks ago. So we're monitoring that. I mean, we don't want to do anything that contributes to one of our main hospital systems going under, while at the same time making sure prices are competitive and the quality and accessibility for Delawareans is really high.
You're listening to our interview with Governor Matt Meyer. We wrap up that interview next, asking the governor about how actions in Washington, D.C. are affecting the first state. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we're bringing you an in-depth interview with Governor Matt Meyer here on The Green. Meyer joined me and Delaware Public Media state politics reporter Sarah Petrowich earlier this week. And in the final portion of that interview, we discussed how actions in the nation's capital are affecting Delaware.
You talk about some of the impacts of things that are being done in Washington or having here in the state of Delaware. Your administration, the Attorney General Kathy Jennings, has spent a fair amount of time fighting with the Trump administration over a variety of issues.
I think Trump started the fight, is my view. It's not Kathy Jennings picking a fight with them. It's Trump picking a fight with us.
I understand it. And just in the past few weeks, you've seen things like access to transgender care, ICE seeking state labor department records from Delaware. How much does fighting these battles, taking away from dealing with the issues, many of which we've talked about already locally, is it an unnecessary distraction that takes away from getting the things that you want done, done?
Look, if I were running the country, I'd run it pretty differently right now. I think a lot of the things President Trump is doing is straight up an attack on the working class. I think it's an attack on people's private sexuality. Some of the things they're saying now about Obergefell, which is the court case that created a right to gay marriage. Some of the things they're saying now that Secretary of Defense is saying about women serving in the military. Like, it's embarrassing. It isn't who we are as a country. And if you're saying, should we be standing up to that 110% of the time? It's the kind of thing, if I don't stand up to that, I don't think I can look my mother in the eye, and I don't know how I continue serving. At the same time, I'm eager to work with the president. Part of the big bill is baby bonds. Baby bonds has been talked about for years. Why don't we, for lowest income Delawareans, put aside some money when they're born? Just sock it away in an account, have it earn interest or some kind of return, so that when the baby turns 16, 18, they'll have money for college, for a house, for job training. Why don't we do that? It's been talked about for years. The big bill is doing that. We're looking at how do we in Delaware take extra advantage of this and say, hey, this is not just one place, one of 50 states to have a baby. This is the best place in America to have a baby. And that's something we'll do in collaboration with the Trump administration. I recently met with RFK Jr., the Secretary of Health and Social Services, and Dr. Oz, who runs the Center for Medicare and Medicaid. A lot of what they say, I don't agree with. But they're talking about getting junk food off of kids' plates. And I'm supportive of that. And I'm saying, how can we work together to do that? So I think you got to be mature enough in these jobs to say, listen, there's a lot we don't agree on, but there are a few things we agree on. And for the good of Delaware, I'm here to serve Delawareans. I don't really care. You may be really supportive of President Trump and what he's doing, but I hope we'll show you we're here to serve you too.
Talking federal funding cuts, a lot of it has kind of been a waiting game, it sounds like, you know, as far as how can we determine how these cuts will actually directly impact Delaware and what can be done. I know that was talked a lot about during the budget process. Two of the main concerns, which we've touched on, have been cuts to Medicaid and SNAP. At least one of the changes to SNAP starting in October 2026 will be that all states will have to start covering 75% of the administrative costs. For Delaware, that means the state will have to come up with an additional $16.5 million. And this is just one of the areas where additional funding will be needed, right? So now that there seems to be a clearer picture of what the effects of DOGE and the Big Beautiful Bill are, what have discussions been like around how Delaware will be impacted and how it can cover those cuts?
Well, we're doing everything we can to leave no one behind. I mean, with respect to food assistance, with respect to Medicaid, as you mentioned, and health care. Something that's not being talked about a lot is that many Delawareans, I know 10,000, maybe tens of thousands, get their health care because of subsidies on the Affordable Care Act market that are going away as of the end of next year. In addition to some of the stuff they're talking about doing at the Education Department and funds that are likely to be cut. Right now, we're looking at an overall impact of tens of millions of dollars. We have a $7 billion budget. So when tens of millions of dollars goes away, it's not good news. But it's a way, you know, you're talking about 1, 2, 3%. We think we can find the resources to continue, maybe not all, but many of these programs. We're also, quite frankly, using this as an opportunity. A lot of people on the right who are supportive of President Trump level really hard criticism against a lot of these programs, saying that they're totally inefficient and they should be, you know, done away with. which I don't agree with. But I do believe there are inefficiencies. And I do believe in some cases, like in our SNAP program here in Delaware, there are inefficiencies that we need to work on. And we need to make sure we're using the latest, greatest technologies. And maybe because federal rules in the past haven't been structured around it, we haven't really put those issues under a magnifying glass and fix them. So we're also trying to fix some of these inefficiencies that we think is going to generate millions of dollars of savings for Delaware. And so we're committed to trying to do everything we can to backfill these programs. There are a lot of nonprofits that are hurting. Latin American Community Center now is out some early childhood money. For example, the food bank has been very vocal about some of the money that they're losing, some of the federal money. We're doing everything we can to create stopgaps while at the same time saying, wait a second, let's use this crisis and use these shortfalls as an opportunity to potentially create efficiencies to serve people in a smarter way.
So it sounds like you're confident that we can make up those cuts somewhere, but we also have a looming state deficit, right? Even after dipping into reserves, there's a projected deficit by fiscal year 2028. You know, you talked about adding personal income tax brackets. That didn't happen this year, but the Speaker of the House said that she is supportive of that, along with other legislators, in making some type of change. What are the talks as of now to bring more revenue into the state? Are we still trying to keep that plan, or are there any other proposals you have to help combat this?
Well, first of all, corporate franchise revenue. It's covered when our corporate franchise is under attack and a Twitter account with a lot of followers comes at us. That's in the news. But what's not in the news is when our revenues keep going up for corporate franchise. There are more entities today, as I talked to you, there are more entities today incorporated in Delaware than ever before in Delaware's history. So there's opportunity there. It's been widely said that we're too reliant on corporate franchise revenue, which I agree with. We have to develop other lines of revenue from the state. I've also said, as you alluded to, the wealthy need to pay their fair share in taxes. I still hold myself to that. Now, saying that and putting together a bill with numbers that you're able to pass with supermajorities through the House and the Senate is more of a challenge. We're going to keep on working on it. As you said, both the Speaker of the House and the Leader of the Senate, the President Pro Tem of the Senate, as well as the Lieutenant Governor, have pledged support in principle to it. But again, when you get down to the numbers, it's not quite as easy.
We've talked about a lot of things making headlines. Is there something you feel like your administration has accomplished since you took office that hasn't made headlines but should be?
Made a few headlines, but I'm proud that there are nearly 18,000 Delawareans who, as of a couple weeks ago, had medical debt, crushing medical debt that according to their income or according to the amount of money they had in the bank was simply devastating to them. I think we all know people who chose to get a cancer treatment for grandma or for themselves or for a spouse or for a child. And it sort of impoverished the family, where family members couldn't go to school or had trouble making mortgage payments. And for nearly 18,000 Delawareans, we've eradicated that debt. We've erased that debt with $500,000 of public expenditure. I think that's the kind of society that we should live in the 21st century, where we say, hey, if you're hard on your luck and you just got a cancer diagnosis, you just got, you know, you have to go to dialysis every month and you can't afford it. This is America. You go get what you need for your health, and we as a community will throw in a few pennies each or a few dollars each to make sure everybody's okay.
I want to finish on a lighter note. We talked about significant, heavy issues. Your job as governor, though, does have some aspects that are a little bit more fun. What's the most interesting thing you've gotten to do in your official capacity as governor so far? It's a day you said, you know, I'm really glad I'm governor today.
I got to admit, Tom, Dover Days was not the reason I ran for governor. It was not, I'd seen past governors get dressed up. I saw Mayor Christensen, Robin, every year get dressed up like he was out of the 1700s. My wife and kids said, no way. But we went in full speed and had a good time. I think the family's looking forward to it next year. I can't pick just one. NASCAR, I had years and years ago, I went to the Pocono 500. A NASCAR race, and I went to Dover Downs this year, for the Miracle Mile. It was really cool. I maybe made the mistake of watching Talladega Nights the night before. So I'm filled with Ricky Bobby quotes. If you're not first, you're last. My wife kept saying, when you're in like the box with the owners, you can't just start yelling, if you're not first, you're last. You're not. But listen, it's every day I wake up and realize how humbling it is for a Delaware kid. My grandparents fled Europe in fear of being persecuted in the Holocaust. They came here. My great-grandfather didn't speak English when he got here. My grandfather was 3. Great-grandfather worked as a chauffeur for wealthy people around a town in northeastern Pennsylvania. And it just makes me proud that kids in America, you know, you can have a shot here. There are kids down in Georgetown who maybe are the kids of Guatemalan parents who maybe don't speak the best English or don't, you know. And I just want kids to know you got a shot. Like, keep your head down, work hard, and even in this little Delaware, anything can happen.
Thanks to Governor Matt Meyer for joining me and Delaware Public Media State Politics reporter Sarah Petrowich on The Green this week. A reminder, you can find Sarah Petrowich's award-winning coverage of state politics in the First State anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Arts Playlist, where we meet a Middletown artist whose work is on display at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery this month. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Division of the Arts continues its work, spotlighting First State artists at the Mezzanine Gallery at the Carvel State Building in Wilmington. This month, the gallery's exhibition features Shilpi, a Middletown-based artist with a diverse set of influences and a love for animals, the natural world, and traditional Indian art. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Shilpi speaks with Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny about her art.
Let me start by just asking about your background and your journey as an artist.
Okay, so since childhood, I'm interested in art, and then my parents identified that I am good at art. So we chose this field, and I have done both the degrees, bachelor's and master's in fine arts. And in addition to that, I have done interior designing, fashion designing, and textile designing. So related to art or any creative field, I just want to learn. So that's what. And I have done the teaching course also in India. So I'm teaching art. I used to teach art in India. Here also I'm running my art studio in Middletown.
And as you sort of mentioned, you work in a lot of different medium. You do charcoal, you do oil, you do acrylic. And I wonder how all of that plays together into helping you grow as an artist.
Yeah. So, you know, if somebody, I think it's with everyone who is artist, they can't stop themselves to create a piece in any kind of form. So charcoal gives me that black and white, smoothness on paper. That gives me another texture to my art. So I love to do charcoal. I love to do oil because it's it is good in blending. And then you wanted to create some more natural themes like flowers and landscapes. So I mostly use oil. About the acrylic, they are all bright colors. So whenever I wanted to do something bright, when I'm mostly I'm very much happy and then I just wanted to create something with the bright colors, I use acrylic. And folk art is a totally different thing. That is called meditation for me. I mean, you see they have a lot of patterns. So when you go through with that, you are fully involved in you. You are not somewhere else. If something going on somewhere, you can't focus on that. You're just into meditation with art.
So it's kind of like the different media or sort of different tools in your toolbox, depending on what you want to express.
Exactly. Mostly, I would say in every medium and every style, I choose nature. Nature is like my Yeah, my way, I think, to choose. Like my inspiration, I go out if I see something, some animal or something, I wanted to create in my style. And like which inspires me a lot. Like sometimes, you go to beach and you see a lot of birds. Sometimes when you see them, you feel so calmness, and then you wanted to create in your art. Sometimes it happens with me. So nature is the biggest inspiration for me.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of artists kind of find soothing and solace in
Exactly.
nature and then transport that into their work.
Yeah, exactly.
I was looking at some of your work and I was really struck by some of the Indian influenced pieces and just how bright and vibrant and colorful they are. You mentioned that a moment ago, and I wonder about the importance of color to you and how you use color.
Sure. In Indian, like Indian folk art especially, when you say about the brilliant, like bright colors, it's only in Madhubani art form. It is a form, like we have a lot of art forms, like folk art forms in India. So Madhubani is one of that, and then I inspired from that patterns, and then so those have really very bright colors. And for that, like in back in India or back in, when they started with natural colors. So natural dyes are so bright, and maybe I can say talkative. When you see something bright, it feels like you're connecting something. So maybe that's the main reason I used those bright colors.
I would love to ask you to just describe a work or two of yours that's on display at the mezzanine gallery that people could see.
So I will tell you about the most favorite ones of mine. One is, and like you can see when you enter through the gallery, it was like a first painting I have kept called Peacocks in Paradise. So when I was creating that artwork, peacock is my favorite bird. So why? Because I, like the colors, the colorful feathers, I love them. So I wanted to capture those. And then I wanted to, like, the sun is rising there, and they're talking. And then the god is watching them from the window. And then you can see that those peacocks are talking, or they're enjoying the sunrise. And whoever is watching them, or maybe divine is watching them, or God is watching, whoever, like me also, as like watching them, feeling the same feeling, okay, when we see the sunrise, how it feels. So in that you can see a lot of intricate petals there. I gave a lot of details into that. Why? Because I wanted to create in that form, in which way you create each leaf, and you wanted to create the story especially. So that tells the story of my paintings.
What do you hope people who see your work at the Mezzanine Gallery, what do you hope they'll take away from being able to experience your art?
Okay, so let me tell you, let me share one thing. Like when I go out in the nature, I generally connect myself through divinity. Like when you go, and then when you see some trees or some what inspires you, you feel like, wow, what divinity has done with this nature, like it's beautiful, right? So I and then few elements also makes you happy, natural elements. So if people are taking them home, they'll take that happiness with them. So each and every animal also, they describe, like peacock describes them the colorful journey to your life, because it has all the colors. When you have peacocks in home, especially as painting, you'll see the colors, and then that colors will create some harmony in your mind, and then you'll feel always colorful. You'll feel that, yes, you don't feel depressed. So every animal has some meaning. I think I have fishes also, a lot of fishes in my paintings. Even in my home, I have fishes, three fishes.
Well, Shilpi, thank you so much for your time and best of luck with the rest of the exhibition.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Martin. I was really happy to share my experience with you. I hope people like this and they enjoy the show.
Thanks to Middletown-based artist Shilpi and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. Shilpi's work is on display now through August 29th at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington's Carville State Building. To learn more about Shilpi and her art, visit shilpifinearts.com. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. You can find the interviews you've heard online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. And a reminder, if you like what you hear each week on The Green, now is the time to support it during Delaware Public Media's 15th anniversary fund drive. You can support The Green and the great local journalism our team produces each and every week by going to DelawarePublic.org and clicking the donate button. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petrowich. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsink. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.